my friends. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. The website is weekendinterviewshow.com. Keep all the archives for you there in MP3 format, including a previous interview of my next guest, which I only just re-listened to about a week and a half ago, which is excellent, if I do say so myself. James Bamford. He's a former investigative producer for World News Tonight on ABC. He's written investigative pieces for the New York Times Magazine, the Washington Post Magazine, and the LA Times Magazine. He's the author of the books The Puzzle Palace, Body of Secrets, and A Pretext for War, 9/11, Iraq, and the Abuse of America's Intelligence Agencies. He has an article in the recent Rolling Stone, in the most recent Rolling Stone, called The Man Who Sold the War, about John Rendon and the Rendon Group. Welcome back to the show, Mr. Bamford.
No, thanks, Scott. Appreciate it.
That's nice to have you on again. And, you know, there's news just recently. The LA Times just broke the story this last week about the U.S. Army having soldiers write articles and plant them in Iraqi newspapers, which leads right to the topic of your article, the propaganda of war. I forget who originally said it, that truth was always the first casualty. And, boy, I'll tell you what, reading your article in Rolling Stone, it sure seems that way. Can you tell us, just very brief sketch, who's John Rendon and what is the Rendon Group?
Sure. In talking about the propaganda war, very few people have an idea how much of the war is waged by contractors, paid for by the Pentagon and the CIA. And the largest and most important of all those contractors, and also probably the most secret, is the Rendon Group. Because the CIA started hiring the Rendon Group back in the late 80s and has been using them ever since on such things as a regime change. And the way it uses it, again, is a public relations firm, but it's being used by the CIA for much more than that. During Panama, when the CIA and the Pentagon went in to overthrow Noriega, they hired the Rendon Group to pretty much prop up the person they wanted to put in to take Noriega's place, the person by the name of Indira. And he took Indira across the across Europe, had him meet the Pope and various leaders around Europe to build up his reputation. And then when his group was attacked by the Noriega supporters and got very bloodied, he made sure that the pictures appeared on newspapers all over Europe and then appeared on the front page of Time magazine in the U.S. And that's pretty much what his job is to, or at least at the time, was to build up the people who were going to be replaced during regime change. And then during Kuwait, he worked for the Kuwaiti government and really built up the Kuwaiti government as a country that needed support and did a lot of PR that showed that Saddam was a good guy to overthrow. And the CIA hired him after that to go much beyond just propaganda and hired him basically to help create a opposition force to Saddam Hussein, basically create a militant force to overthrow Saddam Hussein. It would be a little bit like John Kennedy hiring the J. Walter Thompson advertising agency to do the Bay of Pigs.
That's funny. Hey, that's a good place to leave it. We got to take this break real quick, everybody. We'll be right back. It's the Weekend Interview Show, and we're talking with James Bamford, author of A Pretext for War and a new article in Rolling Stone, The Man Who Sold the War. Be right back. My friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and my guest this hour is James Bamford. He's the author of A Pretext for War and a new article in Rolling Stone called The Man Who Sold the War. It's about John Rendon and the Rendon Group. In this article, Mr. Bamford says that at this point, the Rendon Group has offices in 91 countries around the world and that they've been involved in every American military conflict since Panama minus Somalia. And before we went to break, sir, you're talking a little bit which you started to bring up the INC, and I'd like to get into that in a minute, but I was wondering if I could ask you a little more about the Renan Group's propaganda campaign during the original Operation Desert Storm. I read a quote in your article that I've read somewhere before, I think, where Rendon is joking and bragging and saying, yeah, when the Americans came in and all the Kuwaitis were on the side of the road with their little American flags, where do you think the little American flags came from? And joking about that, can you tell us a little bit more about the role that they played in Operation Desert Storm?
Sure, yeah. They were hired by the Kuwaiti government to boost up the image of the Kuwaiti government. Again, they wanted to get the U.S. as heavily involved as possible in helping to oust Iraq from its invasion of Kuwait, and to get the support of the U.S. public on the side of the Kuwaitis. And so that was one of the things it did. He wanted to create sort of this image at the end of the war of the liberation of France in World War II. So he made sure that he had thousands and thousands of these American flags distributed to local Kuwaitis. But even during the war, there was a lot of bad press because some of the wealthy Kuwaitis had left the country during the conflict and gone to places like Cairo and were living it up in fancy hotels and so forth. And so to counteract that bad press, one of the things Rendon did was to get 20,000 Valentines sent to American troops from, at least supposedly, from a local Kuwaitis.
Oh, that's
I was over there right after the Gulf War in Kuwait, and I never remember seeing any Valentine's Day cards in any of the local little shops there. So I'm not sure where you got 20,000 cards, let alone 20,000 Kuwaitis to sign them. But that was one of the things he did. And again, that was a positive press on behalf of the Kuwaiti government. On the other hand, it wasn't the Rendon Group, but another public relations company called Hill & Knowlton, a very big public relations company that was also hired. And one of the things they did was they took this rumor about it was a false rumor, but it was a rumor that they took about Iraqis going into hospitals and taking babies out of incubators and putting them on the floor and then stealing the incubators. And they made that a huge news story all over the world.
Well, didn't they even get, like, the Saudi ambassador's daughter or the Kuwaiti ambassador's daughter to testify to that before the Congress?
Exactly, but nobody knew she was the Kuwaiti ambassador's daughter. They thought she was just an eyewitness, and she had never seen it at all. And so the whole thing was all made up, but again, it was anti-Iraq propaganda. Again, the two forms of propaganda were it was the propaganda to make Kuwait look good and the other propaganda to make Iraq look bad. So,
and I'm sorry, I don't have a footnote for this, but I remember reading where some reporter or another had gone back and done the research and saw that it was the day after the incubator story had come out. That was the day that the American editorial pages across the country came out in favor of the war. Oh, Saddam Hussein's a Hitler. He throws the babies on the floor to die and steals their incubators. That was the key to really turning the country's support toward invading Iraq back then.
Well, sure, and what it did was it generated even a congressional hearing and the whole thing about how monstrous it was, and that was it. Everybody could sort of picture babies being taken out of incubators and put on cold floors, and the incubators stolen. So it was a key factor for U.S. support for the war in Iraq, and again, the war in Kuwait to oust the Iraqi government, and again, it was very similar to some of the phony stories that came out leading to the war in Iraq we're in right now.
Right, and now you say that after the Gulf War, the CIA, I guess, hired Rendon to pull together the Iraqi exiles and create a government in exile. And I had no idea. I thought I knew all about the Iraqi National Congress. I learned in your article that it was John Rendon who invented the Iraqi National Congress.
Basically, yeah, the CIA paid him to help create the this opposition force, and he helped pull together these disparate Iraqis and who were opposed to Saddam. He helped put together this big conference, pulling them together in Vienna, Austria, and came up with the name for the group. I mean, it was hardly a congress. It was a group of militant anti-Saddam activists who were interested in overthrowing the country. It wasn't a congress. So it was a name that gave it a lot of legitimacy, and throughout the 1990s, John Rendon would get money from the CIA. It was about $350,000 a month, and then he would get that from the CIA. Then he would turn it over to Ahmed Chalabi, who was put in as head of the INC. And then Rendon would take a cut of it for his own, his own salary for being what he himself called the senior advisor to the INC. So what you have is a very interesting situation where you have the CIA using a contractor, a private company, to set up an opposition government funded by the U.S. taxpayers with CIA money. It was similar to if you had a contractor help create the invasion of Cuba during the Cuban Missile Crisis, during the Bay of Pigs operation. So it's pretty scary, since none of these contractors and none of these people ever come under any authority like the Congress or oversight capabilities through the intelligence committees and that type of thing. Those people have very little idea how much of this propaganda is being done by private contractors.
In fact, in your article, you say that up to a half of the CIA's total workload is contracted out.
That's right. I was astounded when I heard that, and that was from a senior U.S. official involved in budget matters. Said that half of the CIA now is contractors.
And this, as you said, this all goes to the issue of accountability and oversight. The Congress usually doesn't exercise too much oversight over the CIA anyway, but they have all kinds of extra hurdles to cross if they want to get information from private contractors working for the CIA, right?
That's right. And, in my Rolling Stone article, I quoted from another senior budget official who said that, and this is a senior budget official in Congress, and said that they had very little idea of how many contractors there were, how many, who they are, what their jobs are. It's very difficult when this information is, it's very difficult when the work is so subcontracted to contractors, subcontractors, private individuals, what they call beltway bandits, these little companies that are sort of formed overnight, like the company that was in the news just recently, this Lincoln Group that was involved in creating these stories to be planted into the Iraqi media. Nobody'd ever heard of the Lincoln Group before. It was a sort of fly-by-night startup company that was hired and was paid millions and millions of dollars. The eventual contract was up to $100 million. I think the person that was running it was 29, 30 years old or something, had been in and out of investment banking or whatever. So very few people have an idea of how many of these Rendon groups, Lincoln groups, and all these other contractors are doing these things for the government.
And when you talk about the if Kennedy had hired an ad firm to run the Bay of Pigs, doesn't sound like it would have turned out too much better than it actually did. But Chalabi and his INC had their own little Bay of Pigs in 1996, right?
That's right. Yeah, that was the entire purpose of forming this group, was to oust Saddam Hussein. And the Chalabi spent a lot of the time organizing sort of a militant uprising to try to overthrow the Saddam government. It failed in 1996. They just didn't have enough. They were hoping to get U.S. support, but Clinton backed out at the last minute and declined to give support to the Chalabi-sponsored coup. And so the coup completely failed. But then Chalabi and his INC, particularly Chalvey, spent the rest of the decade and into the new century lobbying as hard as he could to get the U.S. government to launch another war. I interviewed the former station chief in Baghdad for the CIA, and he said that was Chalvey's number one goal, was to get the U.S. involved in a war, and he finally succeeded. I mean, that's what he said. And
in your article, you write that after the 96 coup, the CIA fired him. They said, oh, come on, this guy is nothing but a walking ad firm. He has no army. And so they fired him. So then Rendon,
they fired him, yeah. Because
and they just went to the DOD.
That's right. The key reason that they disowned Chalvey in 96 was that they tried to do an accounting of some of the money. Again, they're giving $350,000 a month. And they tried to do an accounting of where that was being spent, and they couldn't get any kind of accounting. So they declared him basically a fraudster. But Chalvey never gives up, and he just went to the Pentagon, and they gave him a contract.
I'm Scott Horton. It's the Weekend Interview Show, and we'll be right back for more Perception Management with James Bamford right after this. Friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with James Bamford, author of A Pretext for War, and a great new article in Rolling Stone called The Man Who Sold the War. And let's see, where we left off, the CIA-INC coup of 1996 against Saddam Hussein had failed, and so the CIA audited him and decided to fire him. And so basically what happened was the Iraqi National Congress and John Rendon just went and took their employee from the CIA to the Department of Defense then, right?
That's right. Yeah, the Pentagon, which apparently has less standards of credibility than the CIA, decided to pick up where the CIA left off and continued paying Chalabi. And again, throughout the 1990s, Chalabi kept the pressure on, and his main supporters in the U.S. were the neocons at the time. But it was during the Clinton administration, so they were out of power, and they had very little capability to activate Chalabi, really. And it wasn't until after September 11th that the Bush administration came in that the neoconservatives, primarily Richard Perle and Douglas Fife and the people who have been supporting him all along, continue to push his claims that the U.S. could quickly go into Iraq. They'll be greeted like the U.S. was in France and in World War II as these great liberators, and that they'll have flowers thrown in front of them on the way, and that they'll quickly be able to pull out, and they'll put Chalabi in there as sort of an American puppet. And unfortunately, it never worked out that way, even though that's what Chalabi had been claiming for years.
I wonder exactly what the neoconservatives' role may have been in the creation of the INC in the first place. I know Chalabi studied under Leo Strauss at the University of Chicago, so presumably he goes way back with Paul Wolfowitz and some of the other guys. I wonder, do you know if they had any role in helping Rendon create the INC back in 93?
Well, I don't know what their role was. What their role was exactly. The neocons' connection with Chalabi goes back to the 80s. It goes back quite a ways. Chalabi studied at the University of Chicago. I think that's where he got his PhD, or at least I know he went there during part of his education. And I think one of his professors was I think he either got to know Wolfowitz there, or somehow he got to know Wolfowitz from the University of Chicago, and they became friends in the mid to late 80s, and ever since then they've continued to promote Chalabi as the savior of Iraq. throughout the 1990s, they were constantly having him to the U.S. to give speeches to a variety of different groups. Again, promoting the overthrow of Saddam and the replacement with Chalabi. And, you know, they've almost got their wish. I mean, one of the key areas, the area that I started my article, which shows the amount of deception that Chalabi and the INC were involved in, takes place in December of 2001. This is a time when it was after September 11th and the Bush administration was gearing up for the war, and they needed a lot of public support because most of the public, you know, didn't have much anger towards Iraq at the time. They had the anger towards Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, obviously. So what happened was in December of 2001, Chalabi and a number of his key INC people that had been trained and formerly worked with the Renan Group, brought a defector out of Iraq, a guy by the name of al-Hadari, and they brought him to Thailand. And the first thing they did was they debriefed this person, and they spent a lot of time, I guess, pumping him up or doing something for about 10 days with him. And by the end, he had this enormous story about how Saddam had buried these weapons of mass destruction all over Iraq, and that he was an eyewitness because he was an engineer who had helped create the structures in the ground to hide these weapons, and even included nuclear weapons and so forth. So the INC asked the CIA to come over. The CIA went over, and they interviewed him on a polygraph machine, a lie detector test, and for about 8 hours, and the end result was he completely failed it. I don't think he answered a single question truthfully, even the ones about him being an engineer. So the CIA official flew back to Washington with the negative results of the polygraph exam. But that didn't deter Chalabi and the INC. The next day, they called up their two best friends in the media. One was Judy Miller of the New York Times.
Surprise,
and they gave
surprise.
Her worldwide print exclusive rights to interview him. And they called up another friend, Paul Moran of Australian Television, and asked him to come up for worldwide television exclusive rights to interview him.
Which gets us right back into the Renan Group again with Paul Moran. All right, everybody, we've got to take this quick break. We'll be right back with James Bamford, author of A Pretext for War and The Man Who Sold the War in the newest Rolling Stone. We'll be right back. My friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton. My website is weekendinterviewshow.com. I keep all the archives for you there in MP3 format. And I'm talking with James Bamford. He's an intelligence reporter, formerly with World News Tonight on ABC. He's written for many major papers. He's the author of Puzzle Palace, Body of Secrets, both of those about the National Security Agency. And his most recent book is called A Pretext for War, 9/11, Iraq, and the Abuse of America's Intelligence Agencies, which I highly recommend myself. And also, he has a new article in the most recent Rolling Stone called The Man Who Sold the War, all about John Rendon and the Rendon Group, a PR firm that we will see played a great part in convincing you and I and our neighbors to support the war in Iraq. Okay, well, they didn't convince you and I, but they convinced a lot of our neighbors to support the war in Iraq. And where we left off, we were talking about al-Hadari, who was an Iraqi National Congress defector who claimed to have buried weapons of mass destruction all over Iraq. And you say in your article, and you just said, they knew he was lying from he had so terribly failed the polygraph. It's kind of funny. But anyway, but that didn't matter because I believe, as you say in your article, there was, quote, a clandestine operation to sell the war or to sell the unprovoked invasion to the American people. This clandestine operation against the American public. And so this guy, Al-Hadiri, claimed to have buried all these weapons of mass destruction. And the INC brought in Judy Miller, of course, from the New York Times. And they also brought in a reporter from Australia, from the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, called Paul Moran. So can you tell us, please, a little bit the background of this guy, Paul Moran, who he was and what his involvement with Rendon was?
Sure. They brought in these two people, and they were the only two reporters that they were going to allow to interview Al-Hadiri, which tells you something. It means that they trusted these people not to ask any really tough questions and to tell the story pretty much as dictated to them, and then not let anybody else have a chance to cross-examine or question Al-Hadiri. But they brought in, as I said, Judy Miller from the New York Times, and she had a long history of helping Chalabi and the INC propagate its pretty much disinformation campaign on the front page of the New York Times. And then they brought this other journalist, a television journalist from Australia called Paul Moran. And Paul Moran is very interesting since they gave him worldwide television rights for the story. In addition to reporting for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, Paul Moran also had previously worked for Chalabi and the INC, as well as for John Rendon and the Rendon Group. So you have the ultimate conflict of interest where this journalist is doing this story for his previous employer and putting the story out on world television without any indication that that this was the person he used to work for. So, and this was probably one of the most important stories of for a very long time, because up until this point, very few people were convinced that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. It was pretty much an area that was rumored about, that was talked about, but there was no real evidence.
Well, in fact, Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell had already publicly before 9/11 said he's disarmed and in a box and not a worry.
That's right. Colin Powell in January of 2001 went on television and said that he's not a threat anymore. He's defanged. He's boxed, and we don't have to worry about him. So what they had to do was to convince the American public, the INC and Chalabi in particular, had to convince the American public that he was a dangerous threat, so the U.S. would go in and invade Iraq and put him in as president. So he came up with a defector, and Judy Miller did her part. She did a front-page story, I think it was December 20th, 2001, front-page story in the New York Times, and it was a big banner headline about eyewitness tells of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and she even brought up the nuclear, his supposed evidence of nuclear weapons, and that was sort of the opening shot in the fraud war that led to the war in Iraq. It was the principal article that sort of led the propaganda campaign that eventually ended in the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
And you say also in your article that despite the CIA having found that this guy was basically making up his story out of whole cloth, somehow Judy Miller couldn't find anybody to say that. The only quote that she had was that his information was, quote, reliable and significant.
That's right. I mean, you would think with all her ballyhooed intelligence sources, she'd be able to find out that he failed the polygraph just a couple of days earlier. But she didn't indicate anything like that in her article. There's very little skepticism in the article at all. And that's what led to a lot of people believing this. And what made it very useful for the White House and the Pentagon was that the next day or a couple of days later, the senior officials in the Bush administration would go on TV shows like Tim Russert's Meet the Press and so forth, and they would say, well, did you see that front-page story in the New York Times yesterday? I mean, that proves that Saddam's a dangerous threat.
Right,
these government officials knew, I mean, they had the intelligence or the polygraph report from the CIA officials who did the polygraph saying he was a complete liar, yet they would go on and about 9 months later when George Bush was going before the U.N. in New York, making a speech before the General Assembly in New York. They put out a long paper, and it even quoted again from al-Hadary, saying that offering that as proof. And obviously, Bush had reports from the CIA on the truthfulness of this conversation. I would imagine that as soon as the CIA saw the front page story in the New York, they sent out notices to everybody in government that the guy had flunked the polygraph exam. But the public never heard. I mean, the public never heard that.
Well, it's the same story over and over too.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So the coup de grace of the whole thing was that soon after the invasion took place and U.S. controlled and occupied Iraq, they took Hadary over there, and they said, "Okay, now you know we control Iraq. Now you just take us around and show us where all those weapons are that you said were buried." And he couldn't find a single weapon. I mean, he couldn't find a single hole that he said he had constructed. He even said that there had been a secret biological lab constructed underneath the principal hospital in Baghdad, and there was no such thing there. So not only had he flunked the polygraph, it was absolute proof when he couldn't locate any of the locations he supposedly had constructed for these weapons. Yet, as I was doing the article, that document where the White House quoted from al-Hadary was even still on the White House website, believe it or not.
Right, and that's the one you talk about in your article. It's called Denial and Deception is the title of it, right?
An ironic title. Yeah. Since it's supposed to be Denial and Deception created by Saddam, when in fact it was a deception that was in there created by the White House.
Well, and we just found out a couple of weeks ago, too, that the DIA had told the White House that, I believe his name was Azzam, that he had admitted, quote-unquote, to Saddam Hussein training all these al-Qaeda guys and how to hijack airplanes and all this other stuff. And the DIA had reported to the White House that, listen, they tortured this out of this guy, and he told them anything they wanted, and none of the other intelligence corroborates it, and this isn't true. And they continued to use that.
Exactly. So, I mean, this wasn't an isolated case, and that was, I mean, this is really the first war that we've ever gone into, not as a result of being attacked like in Pearl Harbor, but as a result of disinformation and fraudulent propaganda. I mean, there were numerous instances of the administration knowing that the information they were putting out was bad. The case you just mentioned came out a few weeks ago from one of the Congressional Investigation Committees, and that was the DIA saying the information was bad, and the case I've mentioned involving al-Hadary, the CIA said the information was bad. But the Pentagon had their own, they created their own small little intelligence unit to bypass those kind of intelligence agencies and to gin up their own intelligence that fit the policy that the administration wanted. And that's actually what, you know, if you remember the Downing Street memo, that's exactly what the Downing Street memo was. That's when the head of the British intelligence, MI6, came over to Washington, and then he went back to, this is the summer before we went into the war, and he went back to London and made a very secret report that eventually got leaked. And the report said that the White House plan is to wrap the intelligence around the policy. In other words, they're going to ignore the real intelligence and just go ahead with their policy and then make the intelligence fit, which is the complete opposite of what you're supposed to be doing.
Which this is really what your book is about too, and it's funny now to see, you know, what, 2 years since you published this book or so, I think.
About a year and a half.
And now they're finally catching up to where you were back then.
Well, it is sort of like deja vu looking at some of these things that are coming out now that I wrote about. Came out in about May, I guess it was, of 2004, and then the paperback just came out this year with an update in it, but. Yeah, a lot of those things were available to, you know, people if they wanted to dig hard enough, but it took a year. I wrote about a lot of the lies and the fraud from Judy Miller back then, and it's only now that the New York Times has sort of finally got a hint. You know, all that information was out there. They just never decided to act on it.
Well, and if anybody wants to know, just Google Doug Feith's office. That's a good start, I think. And really, that is what we're talking about, is what Larry Wilkerson, Colin Powell's aide, is now calling the Cheney neocon cabal, the Office of Special Plans in the Pentagon, and the rest of the ex-Trotskyoids in the vice president's office, right?
Well, they just announced a couple weeks ago that the Inspector General is launching the Defense Department Inspector General is launching a investigation in Feith's office, because that's really where all the disinformation came from. It was where all the phony defector information was filtered into. It was the office that created the Office of Special Plans, created this other secret little office run by a guy named Wurmser, who was creating this separate intelligence channel. So that's sort of the heart of it all. And
well, that's also where the guilty Israeli spy Larry Franklin worked, isn't it?
Exactly. That's where Larry Franklin worked, who's pled guilty and admitted that he passed secret information onto AIPAC. So there's so many horror stories coming out of that office, and Feith resigned or announced that he was going to be resigning soon after the a lot of this Larry Franklin case began becoming public. So it's very interesting to see whether, you know, how much of his office will come into play during the trial.
Well, it very will be, it very much will be interesting. You talk about in your book, as Julian Borger and Robert Dreyfus and others have talked about, ties directly between the Office of Special Plans and Ariel Sharon's government.
Yeah, Ariel Sharon had a very similar type of a unit in his government. It was a unit that was working very closely, yet very secretly, with Feith's office. I wrote about this colonel that worked in the office who said that the Israeli generals would come in there completely secretly. They wouldn't, unlike anybody else, they wouldn't even have to sign into the office, and they'd be coming in there all the time, all throughout the summer. And then Sharon's office had this similar group that was ginning up information about how dangerous Saddam was, and there was a study done after the war, after the U.S. invasion, by an independent Israeli think tank run by a former Israeli army general, and that concluded that that most of the information that the Israelis came up with was also phony. I don't think there's ever been a time when we've ever gone to war based on so much phony information from so many places.
And we've been lied into a lot of wars, so that's saying a lot.
Well, yeah, there's never been a war that we've... there was this war and the war in Vietnam, basically, that we went in for an unprovoked reason, and both these wars are sort of turning out the same way now.
And by the way, you mentioned the colonel that you talked to. That's Lieutenant Colonel Karen Kotowski, and her radio show comes on an hour and 11 minutes from now. So everybody,
that's right. Yeah, she was very brave. I thought she was very courageous in coming out and discussing what went on. There's very few people that have come out and pointed a finger at the Bush administration, particularly inside the Pentagon, at what was going on. And Colonel Kurkatowski was one of those people.
And, you know, another angle to the criminal side of Doug Feith's office, I guess it's probably not illegal to lie a country into war, but specifically violating statutes and such. These were the same guys who were giving all kinds of classified information to Ahmed Chalabi, who, it turns out, was passing it all off to Iran.
Well, that's still an ongoing investigation by the FBI right now, which is very ironic considering the fact that Ahmed Chalabi came to the U.S. in this sort of mode of a visiting head of state almost. And yet he's under investigation for one of the most serious crimes you can imagine, which is the passing on of secret NSA code-breaking information, breaking Iranian diplomatic codes, passing that information on to the Iranian government, which then changed its codes, and deprived the NSA of getting that information.
Well,
so here he's under investigation for that, and yet he comes over here and is treated with the, you know, he's treated like a visiting head of state by the Bush administration.
All right, everybody, we're talking with James Bamford, author of A Pretext for War. We'll be right back. All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with James Bamford, author of A Pretext for War, and also before that he wrote The Puzzle Palace and Body of Secrets about the National Security Agency. He's got a new article in Rolling Stone. It's available online. It's called The Man Who Sold the War, all about John Rendon and the Rendon Group. And one of the interesting things in your article is about the White House Information Group. And you know, when you talked earlier about the echo chamber where all the administration officials would go on TV and say, wow, look what it says in the New York Times today, when they're the ones who put it there in the first place. David Schuster, the reporter for Chris Matthews on Hardball on MSNBC, did a great report about the White House Iraq Group. And now you're adding to my knowledge about that with this thing called the theme of the day, and how apparently they had these conference calls every morning where John Rendon would tell all the Republicans what their talking points were.
That's right. It was a massive effort to sell the war and through propaganda largely, and it worked very closely with the White House Iraq Group, which although Rendon was primarily focused on propaganda overseas, the White House Iraq Group was focused on sort of convincing the domestic media about the need for a war. And Scooter Libby was a key member of that White House Iraq Group. But what Rendon was involved in with that heavily was giving advice on how worldwide media was reacting to U.S. actions. And one of the things that made him very valuable to the White House was, as he told me in the interview I did with him, he could give the policymakers in the White House and elsewhere 6 hours' notice on what hundreds of broadcast organizations around the world would be reporting on 6 hours in advance. So they would be able to prepare a counteraction or a rebuttal or whatever it was. So he had an enormous pulse on the media around the world. I think it was close to 200 countries that they analyzed the newspapers and broadcast media from.
It's funny, you know, you wonder sometimes how they're ready so quickly with their rebuttals to accusations. That's because they knew about it before the story broke in a way that any of us heard it.
But in addition to that, the contract that he had from the Pentagon, and he had about 35 contracts over the last 4 years for between $50 and $100 million, and one of the among the contracts he had, one of them called for creating websites analyzing email content, and it said when directed take part in chat groups and things like that. So
You say he's in 91 countries around the world, right?
Yeah. So and obviously you wouldn't think that if he's going to take part in the chat groups or create these websites that they're going to say have the you know, seal of the U.S. Department of Defense on there, or whatever. I mean, the implication would be that these are not going to be coming out as being from the U.S. government. So obviously, be used for disinformation.
Now, okay, real quick, we got less than a minute, but I want to give you a chance real quick to address Rendon's criticisms of your article, and I can recommend to everyone, if you go online, you can read their rebuttal and then Mr. Bamford's back. It's pretty fun, but do you have anything to say about that?
Well, sure. Yeah, he had a note. Again, if you want to go on the website, he can read his comments and you can read mine, but basically he really didn't deny it very much. He got into a... an issue as to whether I implied that he paid for the dinner or not, which I thought was rather funny.
But, right.
Obviously, I paid for the dinner. I had made no intention of making it look like...
All right. I'm sorry. We're all out of time. Thank you very much, James Bamford. Everyone,
well,
read The Man Who Sold the War in Rolling Stone magazine and A Pretext for War out in paperback right now.